Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Dow at 18,000, GDP growth up 5%. Sounds like the road ahead is paved with gold. Or maybe not. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Adrienne Hill, in for Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you with us this Tuesday, December 23rd. We always say on the show the economy is not the stock market and the stock market is not the economy. But today, they seem to be more or less on the same page. There's a lot of economic numbers out there today. A record day on the Dow, consumer sentiment at an eight-year high. But we'll start the show with the biggie. GDP last quarter grew faster than it has in a decade, 5%. Joining us is Treasury Secretary Jack Lew. Thanks for being with us.
Good to be with you.
This is the fastest quarterly growth we've seen in more than a decade. It sounds like good news, but I wonder, what's the picture look like for the middle class here?
You know, I think it is good news. I think what we've seen over the past several quarters is that the economy is growing at a healthy rate. Growing at the fastest pace in over a decade is significant. You know, we took a lot of steps in 2009 and 2010 to rescue our economy and to build a foundation for growth. And we're now seeing that we're the strongest year for job growth since the 1990s. So I think when you look at the effect on workers, creating more jobs is incredibly important. I think for working families that went through the experience of the Great Recession, there are some deep scars, and they're looking to see it in their pay. They're looking to see it in their family budgets. I think we're seeing signs that this is going to begin to break through, and that's the challenge going forward.
In the White House press release today, it says we have more work to do to boost wages for middle-class families. And I wonder, what's that look like? What's that mean?
Well, I think, it means a few things. First of all, it means that we need to keep focusing on making sure that there is an environment conducive to creating jobs in areas like manufacturing and technology and areas like construction where jobs are good middle-class jobs. I think at the bottom end, it means we have to make sure that we keep working to see increases in the minimum wage so that that workers who are working full-time at least get their income above a poverty line. The growing economy, the confidence in a growing economy will continue to put some steam behind the labor markets and some energy behind what the future looks like. That confidence in the future is going to, in and of itself, be part of what helps create the jobs that create more and more good middle-class incomes.
We've seen very positive growth in the economy in the last two quarters, and I wonder how much of that is about factors that could change quickly, things like low oil prices and the strength of the dollar.
You know, I think that the drop in oil prices is fairly recent. It is serving to reduce the cost of gasoline and to essentially be a tax cut for families that are stretching their budget. That's a good thing. Obviously, it's meant a little bit of a slowdown in new development in some areas, but I think that over time, that will kind of work itself out. The resources will be developed. If it's not this month or next month, it'll be a little bit later. I don't think that the progress we've seen in the economic indicators over the last few quarters are directly a result of oil prices being low. I think it's a result of core strength. You look at the manufacturing and job creation numbers. They started before oil prices started coming down. I think that the fact that we've developed our own energy resources is actually very significant. It's part of the reason that the U.S. is such a good place to do business, because we have political stability, we have the best workers in the world, and we have now abundant energy resources. So, I think that I don't look at it as the developments of the last couple of weeks. It's really the developments of the last couple of years in the energy area that have been more significant.
Now, we know still that people aren't earning much more than they have been, which means that they're borrowing. And I wonder, how healthy is it to have economic growth based at least in part on record consumer debt?
Well, I think if you look at family balance sheets, we've seen a lot of deleveraging take place. So I think family balance sheets are in a better place than they've been for a very long time. So I actually don't think that we're seeing growth now that's fueled by excessive levels of debt. frankly, we're in a place now where I think there's every reason to believe that more people should be able to get mortgages and to buy a home and to take that step where they have the income and the economic record to qualify. What they need is the confidence to go forward and that sense that next year and the year after are going to be better than what they came out of in the Great Recession. I hope we'll bring more people out into the housing market, for example. That's not bad. You know, it's bad if people get in over their head. It's not bad if people who can afford a home buy a home of their own. That's the American dream.
A lot of people, though, are sitting on the sidelines of the housing market right now. How do you pull them back in?
Well, look, I think that, you know, if you look at people sitting on the sidelines, they fall into different groups, obviously. But you had a lot of young people graduate school at a time when they couldn't find a job right away. And they're taking a few years to make a lot of decisions in life to make sure they feel comfortable about the future. A series of good economic reports helps a lot. And if businesses have confidence that the future is going to be better, they're going to invest and hire more. If individuals have confidence in the future, they're going to be willing to take that leap and buy a family home for the first time.
We asked you this last time you were on the show, but it's worth asking again. And that's this, the numbers look great. But when we talk to regular people, I, as a reporter, am talking to regular people, they're still not feeling it. And I wonder what needs to change to really translate these numbers into real life.
You know, I think what we were talking about a few minutes ago is very real. The recession in 08 was very deep. The experience that people went through was very bruising. It takes a while for confidence to come back, and it's taken a while for incomes to come back. We're seeing incomes rise too slowly, but we're seeing incomes rise again. I think that needs to continue. I think that the combination of time and things moving in the right direction will help. But to be clear, there's more work that we need to do. We need to make sure that whether it's in education or in the way we create an environment that's conducive to investment in manufacturing, in housing, there's more policy that we need to do. And the president's actions in 2009 and 2010 have a lot to do with the strength of the macroeconomic indicators today. And I'm optimistic that even in a period of divided government, we will make progress on things that are important to the American people.
Secretary Liu, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
Now, let's look at the markets. The Dow closed above 18,000 for the first time ever today. Traders were pretty much thrilled. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore puts all of today's numbers in a little context.
A broken clock is right twice a day, okay? So don't get crazy. The reason markets were so thrilled today is not necessarily because today's numbers are good, which they are, but actually, ironically, it's because the numbers aren't all great. Great news, you see, would mean sustained high growth for months or even years, and right now, that would be bad news on Wall Street.
If that was the case, I think bonds would have had a much bigger down day. Stocks probably would have been down, too.
Scott Wren is senior equity strategist at Wells Fargo Advisors.
Because it would have brought back fears that the Fed was going to raise rates sooner rather than later.
Fed raises rates sooner, the economic brakes come on, stocks might hurt a bit. But for everyone else, great news is great, and good news is good. And we got good news.
It was a really good GDP report.
Matt Slaughter is a professor at Dartmouth's Tuck School of Business.
An annualized rate of growth of 5% is the strongest we've had in years.
Consumer confidence has been pretty good, too, recently. On the other hand, don't think for a minute that 5% GDP growth is the new norm.
It looks like business investment spending slowed down quite a lot.
Kevin Logan is chief U.S. economist with HSBC Securities.
New home sales are pretty much meandering sideways, hardly any change, and new homes represent new investment.
Finally, the growth we saw this past quarter is a glass half empty kind of situation.
The pickup in growth has much to do with a slowdown in inflation.
Low inflation means low wage growth, for starters, and that's not great for the economy's growth long term. But all in all, things are okay. It's a mixed bag, and a mixed bag is better than a bad bag. Unless, of course, you're on Wall Street, in which case, I don't know. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
By now, you know what the markets did today. We'll have more details when we do the numbers. It used to be that tobacco was a fixture of life in America, but that changed in the late 90s when states sued tobacco companies for health care costs. States want an annual payment pegged to cigarette sales to last as long as cigarettes are sold in this country. The money was supposed to treat smoking-related illnesses and to get people to quit. But today, that river of money flows not into health care, but into the bond market, where, according to documents acquired by investigative reporting organization ProPublica, there's been a kind of financial crisis. Stan Alcorn with ProPublica's Cesar Podkol brings us a story of cigarettes, securitization, and rating agency manipulation.
That hiss is the sound of oxygen flowing up the nose and into the lungs of Bernadette Vodders.
It's not bad, you know. I practice rhythmic breathing, so...
Vodders has lung disease, and she says she wouldn't be breathing at all if it weren't for a program here at the Metro Health Hospital in Cleveland that helped her finally quit smoking.
Or if I'm power walking, which helped me to lose the weight over the summer.
Originally, this program was funded by the annual payments pegged to cigarette sales from tobacco companies to the state of Ohio.
That funding was great funding.
Dr. Sherry Williams is MetroHealth's medical director for all things lung-related.
Because it not only paid for the program, but it enabled us to have more classes.
These kind of programs helped make Ohio a national leader in reducing smoking rates. But then in 2007, Ohio's then governor decided to take those annual payments away from these health programs and securitize them. The way that works is a bit like an ad you may have seen.
I have a structured settlement and I need cash now.
Call J.G. Wentworth, 877-CASH-NOW.
Ohio wanted that cash now, not for tobacco control, but for schools and tax cuts. But instead of calling J.G. Wentworth, Ohio called J.P. Morgan and Citigroup, UBS, Bear Stearns, these banks that had been pitching states saying they could get them upfront cash in exchange for years or even decades of that annual cigarette money by turning it into a new kind of bond. This is where the rating agencies come in. Bill Harrington is a former analyst at Moody's.
All bonds that access a public market need to be evaluated by the rating agencies. So it's sort of like you have the Atlantic and the Pacific Ocean, but to get to them, if you're going to use ship, you have to go through the Panama Canal.
The rating agencies, Moody's, Fitch, Standard & Poor's, they were the canal keepers. They analyzed bond proposals for their creditworthiness and, for those they let through, assigned a letter grade rating, telling investors how likely they were to be repaid. Dick Larkin is the head bond analyst at H.J. Sims.
The average investor doesn't understand these things, and they rely on something simple, and that's what a rating is supposed to do.
But to be reliable, the ratings need to be independent and objective. ProPublica's Cesar Podkol reviewed 140 documents underwriters sent the states.
And the more and more I collected, the more I noticed these statements.
Statements about swaying those rating agencies' criteria.
Quote, UBS analyzed, re-engineered, and fundamentally changed the underpinning criteria for mainstream ratings.
Bear Stearns bragged about, quote, facilitating the highest ever rating for some of Ohio's riskiest tobacco bonds. J.P. Morgan told Ohio they'd negotiate Fitch, quote, to their knees.
Most of the underwriters involved in this sector made these claims and made them repeatedly on multiple deals in multiple states across multiple years, saying we will get the rating agencies to ease their criteria.
It's a process that is really morally bankrupt.
Mayra Rodriguez-Valladares is a financial regulatory consultant who reviewed the documents. She says it's shocking not that the banks would have this kind of influence, they do basically decide which rating agencies get paid, but that they would flaunt it so openly.
The banks aren't even concerned that this is a problem and are proud to actually incorporate this and make it a marketing brochure.
A lot strikes me about these documents. None of it surprises me.
Former Moody's analyst Bill Harrington says it's basically a repetition of what happened in his corner of the ratings world, the collateralized debt obligations, or CDOs, that blew up in the financial crisis. Banks pushed the agencies to pump up ratings in order to get more money up front.
What we saw in the financial crisis, though, is extracting money up front from the deals means that the deals are not robust when there's a problem.
And like for CDOs, there was a problem with tobacco bonds, those cigarette sales. They dropped much faster and further than the ratings allowed for. Moody's, for the bonds it rated, now expects up to 80% of the money owed won't be paid out on time. The risky Ohio debt that got the highest ever rating has been downgraded 5 times.
Some of those bonds may never get paid at all.
Bond analyst Dick Larkin says if that happens, the settlement payments won't return to the state, something Ohio debt manager Kurt Kaufman confirms.
They would not revert back to the state, right? They would continue to be pledged to the bondholders.
Which would mean no cash coming back to any of the anti-smoking programs defunded to create the bonds in the first place. Dr. Sherry Williams at Metro Health in Cleveland says that since that funding cut, smoking rates have crept back up across the state. And with them, the medical costs that brought on the lawsuit in the first place.
Smoking is the leading cause of preventable death and disease in this country. And we backpedaled, and we're going to end up having to pay for it.
As for the rating agencies, each of them denied negotiating ratings criteria with the banks. But none of them would agree to an interview for this story. In New York, I'm Stan Alcorn for Marketplace.
Coming up, can you guess the most popular Christmas special on TV? Here's a hint.
The number one title is something that, you know, has no words at all and it's not even a movie.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 64 points, a 3% to close at 18,024. It's the first time the Dow has crossed that 18,000 mark. The Nasdaq fell 16 points, a 3% to finish at 4765. The S&P 500 advanced 3 points, 1% to end the day at 2082. Drugstore chain Walgreens shot up 3% after reporting better than expected fiscal first quarter earnings, but many healthcare stocks were still under the weather. Johnson & Johnson dipped 2.3%. Merck moved down 3%. Pfizer fell 2%. Car rental giant Hertz drove up 8.25% today. It said it would raise rates for its Hertz, Thrifty, and Dollar car rentals next year. Bond prices fell today. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.26%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace has been on the air for 25 years, and believe me when I tell you that could not have happened without support from listeners like you. So please, make a tax-deductible gift to Marketplace today and help us keep our coverage relevant and compelling. And you should know that your gift in any amount counts twice. That's thanks to a dollar-for-dollar match from the Candida Fund. Donate at marketplace.org by December 31st and help us reach our goal of at least 2,500 donors. And thank you so much for your support. Also, this is Kai Rizdal, in case you didn't know who this was.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. Tis the night before Christmas. I'm a purist, and I say no opening gifts until Christmas Day, but shaking them is okay. U.S. markets close early, giving procrastinators an opportunity to get some holiday shopping in. And if you're wondering where Santa is, North American Aerospace Defense Command can give you a location. NORAD will be tracking Santa per usual tradition. I hear he can be baited with cookies. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Adrian Hill, in for Kai Rizdal. While things seem to be going gangbusters here, the Russian economy is falling apart. Western sanctions and the dramatic fall in the price of oil have taken a toll on the economy. A former finance minister has warned the country is facing a full-blown economic crisis. We wanted to know how people living in Russia today are actually experiencing the turmoil, what it feels like. So we called up the BBC's Moscow correspondent, Steve Rosenberg. Steve, thanks for coming on.
You're welcome.
So what is the impact right now of the falling ruble on just regular people in Russia?
It's having a big effect on the population here. Prices are rising fast. Inflation is around 10% officially. For example, the price of buckwheat, that's gone up 72% over the last year. Milk up 14%. And people are expecting even bigger price rises come January.
Now, is this just a pinch right now, or is it actually a big squeeze?
It's starting with a pinch, but the squeeze is being felt. Interestingly, the message from President Putin at his annual end-of-year news conference last week could be summed up as crisis. What crisis? I mean, he was assuring Russians that they would get through this, even if it took a couple of years. But if you look at the official data, that's coming out, that looks pretty pessimistic. The central bank itself has been predicting recession next year, a 4% contraction of the Russian economy.
And what is the general sense of people that you talk to in Russia? How are they feeling? How are they making sense of all of these messages and conflicting messages that they're hearing?
I get the feeling that many people are confused. The media is talking about the falling oil price as being a key reason, or Western sanctions being a reason because that makes it harder for big Russian companies to get money on the international markets. But who is to blame here? That is a traditional Russian question. Russians often ask, who is to blame? And people aren't quite sure. I think very few Russians have actually joined the dots and connected President Putin to their growing economic problems.
Do you think that will start happening more?
I suspect that it will. And actually, I made a trip out of Moscow a couple of weeks ago to a town called Ryazan. And I went to a market there. People were selling anything they could find, really, at home to try to make some extra money to supplement their salaries. And I said to one lady who was selling some bed sheets, I said, do you think that your economic problems could be the result of your president annexing the Crimea? After all, your Western sanctions appeared after Russia annexed the Crimea. And she stopped and she thought. It was fascinating. You could see the cogs going round in her mind. And she said, well, I'd never thought about that. I suppose it's possible. And that was really interesting to me because if you watch Russian state television from morning till night, the message being put out is that the West is to blame, that none of this is the fault of the Russian government. And I suspect that as Russia's economic problems build, if unemployment starts to rise, as some fear it will next year, then perhaps more people will start to point the finger of blame at the man at the top.
And how could that play out? What do you see could happen in Russia over the next year?
If Western sanctions remain in place, if the oil price doesn't rise, then there's little doubt that the economic situation here is going to grow more serious. Russia will be sucked into possibly a deep recession. And if Russia is to face an economic crash, I think that's going to hit faith in President Putin quite hard.
BBC's Moscow correspondent Steve Rosenberg, thanks so much.
You're very welcome.
Holiday reruns on TV are as much a part of the season as shopping mall Santas, Black Friday sales, and your relatives getting a little buzzed on eggnog. Jim Burris of WABE in Atlanta takes a look at how networks make money when they're showing us something we've already seen dozens of times. It's part of our series, Holidays, brought to you by
Imagination.
Wonderful products.
Brought to you by...
There are fans of A Charlie Brown Christmas, and then there are fans. Jeffrey Buter is the latter. Every year, the percussionist and a few of his bandmates recreate the Charlie Brown Christmas soundtrack at a local bar. Buter's love for the holiday classic runs pretty deep.
To me, there's just like this warmth and realness to Charlie Brown, and it is funny.
Buter owns the special on DVD, before that VHS, and he makes sure to catch it whenever it comes on TV, no matter how many times it comes on TV. Turns out, lots of us are just like him. According to Nielsen, 9 out of every 10 households tune in to at least one holiday special between Thanksgiving and Christmas.
We'll call him Rudolph.
Rudolph? Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer aired for the 50th time this year. When CBS broadcast it earlier this month, it came in at number 11 in the ratings, with 10.6 million viewers. In 24 Hours of a Christmas Story, which first debuted in 1997,
not rah-rah-rah-rah-rah, la-la-la-la-la,
averaged 3.3 million viewers per showing last year, according to Turner Networks. You can count Michael Rice of New York in that figure. He says he's a fan and catches Ralphie at least a few times every Christmas.
I told you I was going to put you on the spot with a little trivia. Are you ready?
I am ready.
All right. The crate that the leg lamp was shipped in said fragile. What else did it say?
This side up?
No, you're close. The T was missing. It actually says his end up.
Fragile.
It must be Italian.
Well, I think that says fragile, honey.
Turner declined to give specifics on what viewers like Rice mean in terms of ad dollars, but no matter how big or small the audience, networks will make money.
A number of the broadcast outlets own the movies, so their effective cost of putting them on the air is zero.
Chris Limley teaches marketing at Georgia State's Robinson College of Business.
And the cost to the advertiser, since the numbers are going to be relatively low, is going to be relatively low also.
It turns out one of the most popular holiday specials is by far the cheapest, says Elizabeth Raspberry. She's a spokeswoman with Cox Cable, which has about 6 million subscribers.
The number one title is something that, you know, has no words at all and is not even a movie.
It's a 47-minute video loop of a Yule log on a fireplace. Raspberry says it gets twice as many viewers as any other holiday program. In Atlanta, I'm Jim Burris for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
One final note before we finish up today. In every disaster, there is an opportunity, a market for someone. A smartphone app company called Confide is trying to capitalize on the Sony hack. The pitch? They'll make your top secret business messages self-destruct, like Snapchat or those old Mission Impossible recordings.
This tape will self-destruct in 5 seconds. Good luck, Jim.
Pretty much exactly like that, except without the smoking tape player. The best part? They're offering the service free to Sony. So there's one silver lining in there for Sony. And that's our show for this Tuesday. Today, the Dow rose 64 points, a 3rd percent, to close at 18,024. The Nasdaq fell 16 points, a 3rd percent, to finish at 4,765. And the S&P 500 advanced 3 points, 1%, to end the day at 2082. Our special projects team is Nancy Fargali and Millie Jefferson. Lindsay Thomas and Caitlin Esch are on the Wealth and Poverty Desk. Our digital producers are Raghu Manavalan and Tony Wagner. I'm Adrian Hill, in for Kai Rizdal. See you back here tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.